Welcome to Back to My Garden. Discover your passion for gardening. Here's Dave Ledoux.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are in the world when you listen to this. I'm Dave Ledoux, and welcome to another episode of Back to My Garden. And we've got a special guest here today, folks. I'm going to have to put on my student's hat, and it's close to home. David Clark fell in love with gardening through his parents, and it has evolved into the love of teaching others the many aspects of how to garden. David is the horticulture instructor for the Buffalo and Erie County Botanical Gardens and a national garden speaker and an educator at Phipps Conservatory Botanical Gardens. We have a ton to discuss, and he's just down the road from me a couple hours over in Buffalo, New York. Please welcome to the show, David R. Clark. Hi, David.
Hey there, Dave. Hey, listeners. How are you doing today? It's an awful nice pleasure to speak with you about gardening.
I'm excited that you're here. I want to get to know you better, and I know our listeners want to hear your stories. David, maybe take a minute or two and start us off with a little bit about your background and how did you get into gardening?
How did I get into gardening? Well, my dad's dad came from Alabama, and I found out through some genealogy that he was a landscaper. And he used to do events at some of the affluent places down there. And they came back up here. My mom is 86. She's still involved with New York State Federated Garden Clubs. She was a flower show judge, pretty close to getting her credentials for that. So I was around agriculture and horticulture all since I've been growing up. So I think the one way that I got involved in gardening, I remember my dad, I had to be probably, I don't know, 3 years old or 4 years old, if I can remember that. And he took me in the garden in the back and gave me a handful of beans, you know, the magic beans like Jack and the Beanstalk. And he showed me how to make the hill in the ground and put the bean seeds in the ground. And we watered it. And I went out the next day and I dug the seeds up. And I didn't know at that point in time that you had to wait and, you know, wait for the seeds to germinate and things like that. So, you know what? He did not yell at me. He said, that's fine. He says, I'm glad that you did that. Now we're going to go. I'm going to take your hand and we're going to dig him and put him back in the ground. Only this time you have to wait a couple of days. So I waited a couple of days and I dug him up again. And I went to my dad and even my mom was like, oh, look, they're green and they have, you know, these tails on them and they have these big leaves. And at that point, they were out of the sun for too long, and I don't think they were going to continue growing, so we started from scratch again. And I think that's pretty much how I got started with gardening.
Fantastic. That's a good starting point here.
It's fun.
Listeners, David and I are going to sit back, relax, and talk about gardening for the next 25 minutes. I want to invite you to connect with David on social media. I'm going to have all of his links and resources up on the blog at Back to My Garden. You can connect with David on Twitter at David3777. Then David has a website you can connect with him at www.davidclarkwny.com. And David also speaks, you can book him through greatgardenspeakers.com. And that's a good resource to have as well, especially if you have groups and organizations. Where to start, David? I know you do this professionally. Can we start maybe with your own personal experience in gardening? We just finished 2014. What was that season like for you?
Well, I don't know if you folks know about it. You know, up where you're calling me from, up or just over the border from me a couple of hours, I live in Hamburg, New York, actually. And in November, we had the Snowvember storm. And I was in the area that got the 7.5 feet of snow. So I have to tell you, it was hauntingly beautiful when the snow was coming down. And I took some pretty amazing pictures that were published in a garden magazine and also on my my personal page there that people can take a look at. But when everything was done and said and the 7.5 feet of snow got down, you know, 2 feet, 1 foot, and things started to thaw a little bit, I can't tell you the horrific damage that was done to not only my landscape, but other landscapes in the area. I lost a 30-year-old rhododendron that was about 4.5 feet tall on the north side of my house that was literally ripped to shreds by the weight of the snow. I had a 12-foot tall forsythia hedge that when the snow was down and when it lifted itself, it was about 2 feet thick on the ground, just crushed. Arborvitae and a lot of conifers and things like that that were more of the upright types of growth on that type of plant. It looked like somebody had just started from the bottom like a big, huge animal and just ripped each and every branch out of the trunk. So that was a terrible end to the season last year. Otherwise, springtime, we had a great season last year. Not too many late frosts. Sometimes in past years, we live in zone 5A here. And sometimes like around the middle of March when the fruit trees and some of the flowering trees are starting to come out, we'll have a very late season frost, and that can be real detrimental to our fruit growing areas here in Western New York.
Wow, even at your level with your experience, it's still really hard to lose that, especially the mature ones too, that level of damage. We have a lot of listeners who are newbie gardeners and rookies, and you know, they still take it personally when they kill a plant.
Amazing things happening on your shrubs themselves.
Mm-hmm. On the other side of losing all those plants to the winter kill, you almost have like a blank slate to start the new year.
Well, absolutely true. I think that's kind of important. I teach at a site of Buffalo, and it's going to be a tremendous year for the garden centers and for the arborists, because people are going to get out there. They're going to want to have their trees reshaped and pruned and, you know, just giving things a new try, getting some new plants in there. You know, you always have that plant in your garden. It's like, oh, you know, good enough is good enough for now. Well, good enough always turns into forever. So like you said, Dave, it is a chance to get a new handle on this and try something different. Always try something new with gardening. Don't get stuck in the same old thing.
Right. There's never really an excuse to be bored if you have your own garden, is there?
Absolutely not.
The season just passed. Did anything refuse to grow or give you frustration or troubles?
As far as the entire season last year?
Yeah, I'm always looking for stubborn plants that even, you know, green thumb experts have problems with.
Yes, I actually have a Norway spruce that has contracted spruce budworm. And I kept looking at it going, why is this thing dying from the bottom up? And it's not really grown through the top. And it's kind of been hanging on a little bit. And then it just has a little tuft of green at the top of the tree. So I think that's one thing that I really couldn't get to grow last year. Western New York can also get really horrific droughts in the summertime. And I'm the type of gardener that, you know, sometimes you do have to water, but I look at my plants going, you're either going to make it or not, okay, because you're not going to get too much extra water out of me. So I try to get really hardy plants for my yard. The yard, like the turf, I don't water that thing. I'd rather see it just like go dormant. I'll save my energy for doing gardening instead of that.
Okay. A lot of listeners are like Texas, Arizona, California.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they're in the same boat.
Yes. Oh, California is in a horrible position with their water.
I mean, even on social media, they were taking photographs of people watering their cars or watering their lawns and almost like water shaming.
Well, you know, that's not a really good thing to do, because I teach sustainable landscaping classes, and sustainable water practices for the home gardener is a really good one, too. And, you know, you find out that of all the water that's on the earth, you know, of 100% or 97% of the water, there's only 3% that's available for, you know, human usage. It's called potable water. So you have to be a little discriminant on what you do and how you practice your water techniques and things like that. So if you are in a drought, I always recommend don't do the overhead sprinklers, you know, that go back and forth on the top, because you're going to lose 50% of the water that comes down. And, you know, over the last couple of years, the incredible advances that have been made on soaker systems and water timers and things like that, that is the way to go. It's the way to go with water.
I'm still here. I'm actually scratching. I'm taking notes to put up on the blog.
Oh, thanks.
Timers, soakers, drip irrigation.
Timers and soakers. Yeah. You know, it's a, I'll tell you a trick. You know, it's a good way to... Well, how much water are we supposed to put down every weekday? What do they tell us?
I'm more in the... I'm good at knowing when they've given them too much, when they get wet
too much
feet.
Water?
That's my, my claim to fame, is I overwater.
You know, they tell us in the books and everything you read, oh, you know, a plant can survive. That's the key word. A plant can survive on an inch of water a week. So that's all people give it, is an inch of water. Well, how do you know you're giving a plant an inch of water a week? The easiest way to measure that thing is to take a tuna fish can or a cat food can, which is how deep? A couple
that's
of inches?
Yeah.
1 or 2 inches?
Tops, yeah.
Okay. So you're out there with your hose or your sprinkler or your drip system or something like that, and you put that little can in the path of the water, and you can see when you have put down an inch of water. The trick is you got to have a watch on or a clock so you know when you started. Okay. So once you figure out that, oh, that hose is going to put down an inch of water every hour. Okay. Remember what I said, plants will survive on 1 inch of water. To thrive, they need 2 inches of water a week, or should have. So you want to fill that tuna fish can up to the top, that's your 2 inches, once a week.
See, that's the wisdom I love of doing this show. You could Google all day and not discover the tuna can trick for watering. That's good
Dave Clark,
stuff.
Yeah, Dave Clark's tuna can trick for watering.
Very good. Perfect segue into your profession as a horticulture instructor. It must bring you a lot of joy. Are there any specific high points that you like in your career of teaching horticulture?
Well, I'll tell you how we started this horticulture thing. I hadn't been to the Buffenary County Botanical Gardens for many years, and I stopped in one day, and they had kind of heard about me. I'm pretty active teaching the garden clubs in Western New York, and the education director said, you know, would you like to come in and you know, maybe consider doing a class for us? And I go, sure thing. And she goes, what do you like? And I go, oh, I said, I love carnivorous plants, you know, Venus fly traps and sundews and pitcher plants. She says, do you think you could do a class on that? And I go, sure. So it was my first one. It was probably, I think I've been doing this with them for maybe, 2015, probably 5 or 6 years now. And she had me in the basement for 9 people with a Venus fly trap. And I was just learning PowerPoints, and I was just learning about handouts, and got done with a class. And she goes, oh, that's really, really great. Now, why don't, you know, would you consider doing something else? So I came up with like a bird class and a butterfly class. And, people seem to enjoy what I was doing, and I'm pretty entertaining, but I also try to be extremely educational with my work. So it continued on and on with another class here and another class there, and they went from 1 hour to 2 hours, and then 2 classes in a day. And this was Lynn Weiser, the past education director, and she said, I want to meet with you in my office, you know, coming up next Tuesday, if you have time. And I go, sure, okay. So I walked into her office on the Tuesday, and she goes, I got to tell you. She goes, you're so good at getting this information across. You seem like you're having a really good time. You get people laughing within 5 or 10 minutes. You certainly don't take yourself seriously. And she goes, that's a wonderful thing. We've been looking for a long time to have somebody teach an extended horticulture program here at the Buffenary County Botanical Gardens. And she said, I'm a pretty good judge of racehorses, and I think I just found my winner. She goes, would you consider doing it? And it started out with that, with a level one series where I taught 5 classes. I teach a college level botany class with all the plant processes and how they work with the environment. And now that one level class has evolved into 4 classes of over 20 plant science classes. And you know, there's couple hundred folks that take my classes there at the botanical gardens every year.
You know, you've given me an interesting opportunity here, David, because I have a lot of parents that listen to the show.
Oh, fantastic.
Of teenagers.
Great. Yes.
And they're stuck in a kind of a dilemma. Do you go off to university to get a job you hate sitting under a fluorescent light in a cubicle when you'd rather be outside working? And I'm always trying to raise the awareness of horticulture is a viable career path.
Well, yes, it can. I will. let's separate it a little bit. It's a viable career path. Is it a profitable career path? That's what happens when most folks get involved in this thing. Unfortunately, it's not a multi-million dollar job. But I think the enjoyment that you get out of it, I love teaching people. I love seeing that light bulb moment in their head when you look at them and their eyes go up in their head and the smile comes out and you know that they just got it. That's the biggest reward that an educator can get. And yeah, I think that children need to be exposed to gardening, A, to teach them that lettuce doesn't come from a bag. Lettuce comes from the ground. And I'm seeing a very big switch over to this with the influence of all the new community gardens that are out there, especially in urban areas. We have a great program here in Western New York where they're bringing community gardens in. And it's a wonderful way to teach a kid consequences and responsibilities. If you don't water that seed and take care of it the first few days, the first few weeks, you're not going to eat that plant. So, you know, and the other thing I tell people is, you know what, if you teach your kids how to garden when they're really, really small, watch out because they can turn into somebody like me.
We have a whole brand new year ahead of us.
Absolutely.
Do you have any plans to try any new experiments in gardening this year?
I always love experiments. And the one thing that I say to my students and to people that I'm talking to is, you know what, you learn more from your failures than you do from your successes. So don't be afraid to experiment. Always try something new. I am, you know, I grew up in the chemical generation of teaching pesticides and weed control. And, you know, I worked with diazinon and I worked with malathion and I worked with 7 and Pentac and Calthane and all those things. And I'm getting pretty enamored about native plants this year. It's been on the rise, I think, in the horizon of the gardening world. I know there's a lot of folks, Dave, on your blog that are really pushing native plants. So I think that's what I'm going to go into. And I've heard Sally Cunningham is one of my good friends and local authors and mentors here in Western New York. And she does great work with native plants. She's actually written a book on it. And she says, you know, try to aim for 20% native plants minimum in your yard. If you can get to 70%, that's phenomenal. But don't think that you have to rip out your entire garden for that 70%. Start with 20. You know, put a one of my favorite plants, a native plant, would be the fireworks solidago, the goldenrod. Mm-hmm. Tremendous plant. It'll grow 4.5 feet tall. It'll grow 4.5 feet wide. And instead of that tufty cluster like a feather broom at the top, it has long tendrils that come out through the top. And when it is in full bloom, it is just covered by beneficial insects and the colonial bees and all kinds of little wasps and flies and things like that. So I think that's one plant. I have one little pot that I got at Lockwood's last year. And I know when I was down at Phipps Conservatory in the summertime, we had a really huge one in the children's garden outside one of the conservatories. That thing has got to be 5 feet tall and 5 feet wide. It's just a tremendous plant. And you know what? Being a native plant, I'm sure you deal with a soil problem up in your area, Dave. What's the main problem that we have in our soils around this area?
Well, where I am, it's the clay.
It's clay. It's the same thing here in Western New York. Well, why plant native plants? Because they're used to growing in clay. Okay, they can deal with it. They can deal with the fact that when it's hot and dry in 90 degrees, whatever it is in July or August, that their roots are going to go down far enough in the soil horizon to be able to get moisture out of that. That's one of the joys of native plants. Are they as showy as, you know, the Belle of Woking clematis that they developed that has multiple layers of things? Probably not. But you know what? I'll go for the long run on this. Well, I think native plants is the way to go. I also like, you know, the carnivorous plants. I want to experiment with bog gardening too this year.
I love it. I got a big asterisk and a circle around that. You had listed three: Venus flytrap. What were the pitcher?
The pitcher plant, right? Yeah. Sarracena.
Mm-hmm. I'll see if I can.
Now the Venus flytraps aren't native up in this here up in our area, so you have to, like, I bring them to work sometimes, put them in my big floral cooler at the wholesale house. The Sarracenas, the pitcher plants, sometimes you have to just cool them down. I keep them on a cool window in the basement. There are native plants. And here's the other reason why I talk about native plants and bog gardening. It's kind of all woven together. The loss of habitat for these natural plants, okay, and the loss of habitat for the pollinators and the bees and the birds and, you know, the insects. Used to be that we had populations of the spatulate leaf sundew, which is a little teeny tiny thing about the size of a silver dollar, and that grows in peat bogs with really, really clear, cold, fast running water. Sometimes at the bottom of the bog had a quartz sand base. And then there was also the native pitcher plant, Sarracenia purpurea. That's the purple pitcher plant. You'd probably have some of those up in your area. So they're native plants, but they're losing the habitat. And if you can get one or two plants, you're doing your thing for the environment, I think.
That's awesome. Yeah, David, I just glanced at the clock and our time is flying by.
Oh my, are you kidding?
Yeah, the time now in the show where we play a game called Five Quick Questions.
Okay, fine.
This is your chance to share your wisdom and experience with the novice rookie gardeners. Are you ready to play?
I am ready to play.
Just a heads up, I've changed them for the new year, so you have to be nimble.
Nope.
Question one.
Yeah.
What's the funniest or unusual or most embarrassing mistake that you've ever made in a garden that you're willing to admit to in public?
Well, I can't say that I sprayed pesticide in my bathing suit, because that would be pretty shocking, I think. gosh, the worst thing that I ever did. Or the most embarrassing thing?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, I got it. When I moved into my house in Hamburg about 30 years ago, that's about how long this thing is, I had those basketball shrubs in the front of the house. You know, everybody has those five shrubs. And I knew I wanted to, like, re-landscape my yard, but I didn't have any way to get the things out. So at that point, I was driving an AMC Spirit. Just gave away how old I am. And knew I had to get those things out, so I dug around the root ball, and I actually backed my car into my front yard and used a rope, and I ripped the shrubs out with my little car back and forth about six times, and the neighbors were like, who is that guy? And what is he doing?
Oh, that's excellent. That's exactly what I was hoping that I'd get a response like that.
Good, what is good, he good. Doing over there? Now I have a reputation.
Question two.
Yes.
If you were only allowed to grow one plant next year, what plant would you have to grow?
Oh, I like that that new Digiplexus that's out. Have you seen that?
Mm-hmm. I've heard of it, yes.
Yeah, it's Digiplexus. I know we saw it at Lockwood. You can get them online. I know I just got my copy from the American Horticulture Society, and they've got it listed as one of the top new varieties for 2015. The only thing that I don't like about it is a perennial, okay? But it's not a perennial in our area, and that's what I would kind of tell people when you're taking a look at your plant catalogs. It'll say half hardy or HHP, half hardy perennial. Mm-hmm. You got to check and see where it's hardy to, and I think it's a zone 8 or 9, basically a tropical plant. But the flowerscape on it is this really luscious sunset magenta goldenrod spire, and it's got these beautiful felty spatulate leaves on it, and it grows pretty, pretty tall. And I wouldn't say it's a singular specimen plant, but great in mass. So I would probably go with that. I would probably the Digiplexus.
I love how you gave the cautionary note for the zone pushers out there. It's not for everybody. Yeah.
Everything, you know what? Zinnias are a perennial too. They're just not a perennial in our area. Like that's from annuals and perennials class. Tomatoes, okay. Tomatoes grow where? Where do tomatoes grow?
Tomatoes.
Where do tomatoes grow? They're a perennial plant. They grow. You know why they hit those big leaves on them like that with all the separations on it? so they can grow themselves up into the trees. They're from down in Mexico. The Aztecs used to grow.
Oh, yeah.
They're
yeah.
a perennial in Mexico. Okay. But up here in Western New York or Canada, where you are, Dave, they're not.
You see the indeterminates, and they seem genetically for 9-10 feet if they had the space. Yeah.
Right. Well, the new heirloom tomatoes, folks, if you're going to grow a tomato, and if you haven't done it before, get your hands on some heirloom tomatoes. I know, Dave, you grow some in your garden, don't mm-hmm. you?
Yeah, love heirlooms. Yeah.
I saw that black one, the black-shouldered one.
That's right.
Yeah. Tremendous plants. And they're a lot, they're pretty resistant to the wilts and the fusarium and things like that and the blight. So go back to the questions. I'm sorry. I get off on tangents too easy.
Oh, no worries. Question three is about websites. Now, I want all the listeners to go over to your site at davidclarkwny.com.
Thank you. Yeah.
Do you have any resources that you could share, especially with the rookies or the novices websites?
Oh, sure. I did want to tell you one thing. My handle on Twitter, there's a one at the end of it. So it's at dclark3771.
Okay. Yeah, I'll have that. I'll adjust that on the blog.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple really great sites. I was down at the Garden Bloggers Convention in Buckhead, Georgia, a couple years back, and I was pretty blessed to meet with Michelle Slatala down there, and she has a website. She's got a bunch of websites, but the one that she really does a great job is called Gardenista, like Gardenista, I-S-T-A. It's Gardenista.com. I like there. She actually interviewed me for an article on there. But she has great ideas on what are some of the new plants that are happening. She's got articles on how to build fences, how to build a Scandinavian window house from a barn, and beautiful photography that makes you really, really want to try and do some gardening. She has articles that are posted all the way from the West Coast. She's out in California, but she has people that write for her all over the country, including New York City, for urban gardeners of how to grow herbs on your windowsill, how to do hydroponics in a 1-quart soda bottle. So that's a really great site. Another one that I am pretty enamored of, this person, I also met Kim. It's Kim Eierman, E-I-R-M-A-N. I met her down at the Garden Bloggers too. She is actually an instructor at the New York Botanical Gardens and the Brooklyn Botanic, and she teaches for other groups. She has a great website called Eco Beneficial, ecobeneficial, ecobeneficial.com. She's all about natives and the pollinators, because I'm sure everybody's heard about what's going on with the monarch butterflies and the bees and decline and what you can do in your yard to bring it back to, I won't say what it was, because that's an impossibility. She has some very good interviews and videos and things like that. So, I mean, there are so many websites out there. Those are the two. One more would be probably Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous website. So, hard to pick.
Wonderful.
All righty.
That's gold. Good stuff.
Thank you.
Question four, the opposite side of the coin. Do you have a favorite gardening book?
Well, you know, that's like coming up with what are the two favorite garden websites, you know, in the huge world of the internet. I hope everybody has a library at home. Okay. I used to belong to the Garden Book Club. I did it because I got two free books, you know, at one point, and I'd get more books if I bought one every now and then. But I got to tell you, one of my favorite books out of my library at home is one that my mom gave me a couple years ago. It's called Treasury of Gardening. And I think it's authored by a publisher house, Publications International. And I use this thing for reference in my classes all the time. Okay. It has information on annuals, perennials, vegetables and herbs, landscape design, and specialty gardens. And it actually has diagrams inside, like when I teach my garden design class, where you can put a piece of trace paper on the top of it, use your pencils, use your colored pencils, and learn how to design a garden bed. It's a real thick book. It's got to be, I would say it's 4 inches tall, and it's got beautiful gold gilding on the outside of the pages. So you know, A Treasury of Gardening is one of my favorites.
I love it. Question five. If somebody came to your class, David, and said, okay, it's my first day of gardening.
Yay, I love people like that.
What's the first plant that you should start them off on?
If they've never gardened before and they want to see how seeds work, then I'd start them off like I did, germinating beans and growing bean plants. And then hopefully, once they were able to pull a couple beans off their adult vegetable plant, that they would jump on this vegetable gardening craze that's happening. So, you know, starting with a bean, and then I would say go into the vegetables.
Yeah, it doesn't take much to grow a radish or a tomato, does it?
Oh, absolutely not. And, you know, you can grow those things anywhere. There's an urban gardening class that I do where it can raise beds and small spaces and things like that. You can grow carrots and beets and stuff like that in containers. You don't have to have 40 acres in the backyard. You don't need 24 tomato plants. And I don't know if you saw this one, Dave, a couple of years ago. Burpee came out with that patio corn. Did you see that?
No. Like a dwarf?
It's a dwarf corn that you can grow. I wish they had a camera because I'm putting my arms out in front of me here. Like if you put your arms out in front of you and you can't get your fingers all the way together, you can put about 1, 2, 3, 4, about 5 corn plants in that container. They grow, I think they grow about 4.5 feet tall. And they throw maybe 2 or 3 ears of corn per plant. Are you going to have enough to freeze and can and stuff like that for your big family? No. But it's a way to get some fresh produce and some fresh vegetables into your diet in a small space. And they look great once Halloween rolls around, too.
That's right. Nice. See, dear listener, I told you, we'd never fit this into a podcast. We're barely into second gear. But make sure you connect with David on the web at www.davidclarkwny.com. And also visit him at greatgardenspeakers.com and book him for your next function.
Yep, I travel.
David, you've been a tremendous guest.
Oh, thanks, Dave.
I have 3/4 of a page of notes here. We have listeners now in 62
really?
Countries.
Oh, my gosh. Hey, folks.
Can you leave us? I'm going to give you the last word of the listeners today, maybe with either a note of encouragement or a pearl of wisdom.
Let me think here. You know, I got to tell you that gardening can change lives. I know what it's done for me. I've been a florist. I've been a wholesale florist, which is, you know, where my day job here. I've been really blessed to be able to teach people all around the country. And actually, I teach people around the world online. Some of the Middle East places and stuff like that. I would say don't give up on gardening. Nobody has a black thumb. It's all about understanding a plant, you know, and it's easy as how much water does it take? How much sunlight does it take? Okay. How tall does it get? Those are the three easiest things. You know, and another thing I'd like to say is to live is to garden, and to garden is to live. Don't be afraid to pick up that trowel for the first time. And you know what? You're going to have weeds for the first couple of years. There's lots of things you can do. So just pick it up and do it and get off your butt and give it a try and don't be afraid.
Absolutely brilliant. Thanks for being on the show, David.
Thank you, Dave. Good talking with you today.